You're listening to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. In this episode, we'll be talking to Ira Flatow, the longtime host of Public Radio International's Science Friday. Later on, we'll talk to United States Geological Survey research geologist Francis Rengers about what it was like to be researching the tragic debris flows that cost 20 lives in Montecito, California, after the devastating Thomas Fire. First up is a conversation that was a real honor for me, an interview with one of my personal heroes, Ira Flatow. Ira was a production assistant and science correspondent during the early days of NPR and hosted the Emmy-winning educational series Newton's Apple on PBS television. On the hit CBS TV series The Big Bang Theory, Ira played himself interviewing fictional physicist Sheldon Cooper. For decades, public radio listeners have been enlightened and entertained by his enthusiastic, erudite, and insightful interviews of scientists on Science Friday. It's a real honor to have him on Blue Dot, which airs on North State Public Radio right before Science Friday. Ira Flatow, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hey, I'd like to start out. I'd like to find out about your origins, kind of an old chicken and egg question. What came first for you? Was it your interest in science or your interest in journalism?
It was my interest in science. I was one of these kids who used to blow things up in the basement. I used to take apart and construct electronic projects, science fair things. I was the typical nerd with the pocket protector and the pens and the, you know, the broken glasses and that kind and the white socks. So which I still all wear now. So that came first, and then I actually never knew I was going to go into journalism. I had no intention. I was studying engineering in Buffalo, where I went to school, and I really was not enjoying it. So I had done a little bit of technology television. I worked a camera in high school, things like that. And so the campus had a radio station. I said, let me see if I can turn the dials at the radio station. I might like that a little bit. And I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. And they were looking for reporters and training reporters as the Vietnam War anti-war movement came through in the late 60s, came through my campus. And my general manager, Bill Seemering, speaking of the right place at the right time, would leave a couple of years later to start NPR in 1970. So I was 1971 as I was graduating. I begged Bill, get me out of Buffalo. And after a little bit of cajoling, he gave me a job the first year at NPR.
So you literally were on the ground floor of NPR.
I was there the first year. There are over 800 people there now. When I was there, there were 35 people. And you could do anything. The great thing about Bill Seemering and his philosophy about stuff was that if you wanted to do something, you were free to try it. And I basically, in those first years at NPR, did everything, you know, from being a production assistant on up. In fact, Bill didn't want to hire me originally, because I was overqualified. I was a reporter. By the time I was leaving college, I was head of the news division. And Bill said, you know, I need entry-level guys, entry-level people. You're overqualified. For example, I just hired someone named Wertheimer and someone named Stamberg as entry-level people. And they're on the air, you know, the next week or so. I need an entry-level person. And I said, boss, I'll stay, you know, I'll do anything. And then he hired me and introduced me to the staff the first day I was there and said, this is Ira Flatow. He worked with me in Buffalo. He will never be on the radio. And 3 days later, I was on the radio covering the departure of the Washington senators to Texas. And I was off a little while longer in the background working on science stories and other things. But I weaseled my way onto the radio after people realized it was sort of silly that I was whispering questions about science into Mike Waters' ear and him asking the questions of a journalist when I could be doing the same thing. So they relented, and I tried to get rid of my New York accent as much as I could, and it's where it is today.
You could have had no idea then, but if you could have visited your young self, what would you have told them about the institution, really, that NPR has become?
Well, it certainly, I would have said, you know, the first 10 years that I was there is nothing like what it is now. I mean, the first 10 years was a time of great growth and the creativity and trying out new things and long stories. You know, we talk about storytelling now as if we've rediscovered it. When in fact, back in the early days of the very first years of All Things Considered, I know because I helped cut and edit these long 20-minute half-hour stories, half-hour-long stories that used to end the show every once in a while. Not that they're not a creative place now, but it was a different kind of vibe back then where just about anything could be tried at any length. One of the first things I did when I joined NPR was to go back to Buffalo and try to throw a barrel over Niagara Falls with a tape recorder in it. Because it was a cool thing to try.
Wow.
It never made it over the falls. The little dirty little secret about Niagara Falls is in the wintertime, because there are no tourists there and there are 10 feet of ice covering everything, they shut the water down a little to make more electricity for heating homes and stuff. And so the river sort of collapses and you have a little dry side pools and eddies. My barrel, after 45 minutes, got stuck in one of these eddies, and we just picked it up and opened it up and listened to the sound of the gurgling of the river, which, as one local TV news producer who was covering me said, hey, sounds just like a toilet flush. And that was the end of that. Well, we were free to do that kind of stuff.
Well, and you never know, you know, sometimes when you can experiment like that, that's when magic can happen.
Yes. And I'm still, you know, in love with the sound of things and with radio in general. And anytime I can collect sounds or explore sounds, I'm really eager to do that. There was a technology I used to do back then called binaural recording. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And you used to be able to take two microphones and space them apart the same way your ears are and go around recording things. And it sounds more than stereo. It sounds live. So I used to work on things like that. So I still really love radio as a medium.
So you still have some of that engineering geek left in you.
Oh, yes. Got lots of engineering geek in me, yes. And it comes in handy because, you know, we have a very small staff at Science Friday. So I double as the office geek, you know, fixing up the IT stuff and, you know, and getting the wireless to work and the Wi-Fi and other kinds of things like that.
I'd like to ask you about what was the genesis for Science Friday? When did it begin and how did that come to fruition?
Okay, that's a really good question. I had been working, as I say, I started at NPR in 1971, and I left in the mid-80s to do a TV show on PBS called Newton's Apple. And I wrote a book or two in the meantime, and I wanted to get back into radio. But I didn't want to do the daily grind of a reporter's job. I wanted something a little different, and I listened around to what was popular, and talk radio was becoming a local popularity and even on the national scale, but not in the public radio scale. So I went to NPR and Bill Buesenberg, who was the vice president of news and an old colleague of mine. I said, you know, I can raise some money. I can get a National Science Foundation grant to do a weekly science show. Would you like that? And Bill said, that's a great idea, but what am I going to do the other 4 days of the week? And how do I know the stations will want a talk show? I mean, I said, well, you know, there's this guy named Limbaugh and these other people out there doing these talk shows. Once we start one, maybe they'll like it. He said, okay, go away and think about it, what you'll do the other 4 days of the week. And it was sort of lying on the table there until Saddam Hussein came to bail me out. The Gulf War started 1990, and it didn't last very long. But during that period, NPR created a daily talk show about what was happening in the war. And the war was over quickly, but the stations were now eager to continue that daily talk show. And so they named it Talk of the Nation, and Bill said, hey, we talked about your day, you can have Friday. I said, oh yeah, Friday, Science Friday has a nice ring to it. I think we'll do that. And so we've been on the air. Talk of the Nation is no longer there, but we're still there in our 27th year. So we'll keep doing it till we get it right.
I was so happy. I was so sad when Talk of the Nation went away, but so happy that they kept Science Friday. How did you manage to keep it?
Because Science Friday basically is its own independent production. It does not belong. It did not belong to NPR. In other words, it was not a, quote, NPR program. We were purchased. NPR paid us as basically producers, a production company, to do it. Same thing with PRI. And as PRI buys the show, basically helps us fund Science Friday. And so by staying independent, and because I'm sort of an independent guy and didn't want anybody to be able to tell us, hey, you're off the air, or this sort of thing, and having been in radio so long, knowing that you get fired the day before, the day after your last broadcast, I decided that I would work from that business model, that we would be an independent production company. And PR said, great, we're happy with that. And PRI said, great, we're happy with that. And so we're our own masters, and it's allowed us to survive.
Do you have any idea how many science interviews you've done since the beginning?
Oh, I once tried to count it. I mean, I came up with a rough figure of 10,000.
Wow.
Over 40 years. Now, I've been doing this since 19, as I say. My first science story was in college at first Earth Day when I was still in school, 1970. And I had been covering, as I say, anti-war demonstrations and riots and things. Kent State had just happened, or was about to happen. Earth Day, it was April 22nd. I think Kent State was May. So I got an opportunity to do a science story. And it was, I think it was about a nuclear submarine or something that had gone down in the ocean and was lost. I got to interview a scientist about the consequences of how that, what might happen to that, and actually got to sell a little bit of tape to ABC Radio. So that was sort of my first science reporting experience, and have gone on to do some various other stuff and really interesting stuff, and meet interesting people, go interesting places.
Well, I'd like to pick your brain a bit with all those thousands of hours of interviews. For somebody listening to, like, for example, Blue Dot, and a lot of scientists do, and perhaps they aspire to be on Science Friday someday, what would be some tips you would give for interviewees? Some of the things that when they do, that's great, and when they don't, you know, it's better if they don't do that. Do's and don'ts for interviewees.
Don't give me your PowerPoint presentation. I've had this happen. You know, we pre-interview people and we see how well they speak on the radio. And a lot of times they're great in the pre-interview. Then they get on the radio and they get very nervous. And suddenly they freeze up and they don't know what to say. So their mind goes back to, oh, I gave this lecture last week on this topic. And they literally launch into their PowerPoint presentation. Don't do that. Second, practice what you're going to say. Know what points you want to make. Practice it with somebody and be ready. And then when we pre-interview you, you'll know what topics, you know, we've discussed. Three is just be yourself, you know, have fun. Know that, you know, we're there to learn from you and be engaging. And, you know, if you can do those things, you're more or less successful.
It's time for a short break. You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. I'm Dave Schlum. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with the engaging host of Science Friday, Ira Flatow. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's resume our interview with Ira Flatow, the longtime host of Public Radio International's Science Friday. I'm your host, Dave Schlum. Thanks for listening to Blue Dot on NSPR.
What are some things you really love, you know, when an interview is just clicking for you, when you're just like, oh, this is great?
When it goes off on a tangent that I didn't expect, when we discover something, you know, people say to me, you have a whole bunch of questions in front of you. I say, yeah, my staff, I don't do much of the work. My staff does most of the work coming up with questions, but I don't treat it as an interview. I treat it as a conversation. And sometimes really good stuff will happen when somebody, the person I'm interviewing, has a side thought. You know, this reminded me of this, or I thought about this, and we go off on that side, and it really brings out stuff I never expected. Could bring out personal issues. It could bring out how the scientist is thinking. And if it goes too far afield, I'd sort of reel it back in and put it back on a little narrower track. But you come up with some really interesting things, like the time Jane Goodall at the very end of an interview told us that she believed in the abominable snowman. She believed in Yeti. Who knew that? You know, wow. Then we ran out of time. She has said in subsequent interviews that she still stands by it. But you get off on great little sidetracks if you just try to make people feel at home, you know, when they're on the radio.
That reminds me, a lot of times we get this wonderful stuff when the interview's over and we're just talking.
Yes, that's the thing. You know, you'll appreciate this. People say, I have a saying about that, and that is doing live radio is the art of asking the question today that tomorrow you wish you had asked yesterday.
I had one experience like that where I was talking to a young scientist from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We were done with the interview. It was about the Mars rover. And then he happened to mention to me that, oh, the other day this guy brought in a sample that he wanted to test in our lab, and it was the Apollo 11 contingency sample.
Wow!
It was the first sample picked up by Neil Armstrong on the moon, and I'm like, oh my gosh, we've got to talk about that.
That's right. A little throwaway comment. Sometimes I call them the elevator talk, because when I used to interview people in their lab with my microphone, we'd get to the elevator, and as the door was opening to leave, they would come out with that kind of statement. Yeah, and you wish they had said it earlier. But yeah, there are lots and lots of those, and they go away. You know, it's we had Oliver Sacks, who used to be one of our steady listeners, came on one day. Knowing, I called his office. We usually give him an hour to talk. So we knew we had a rare opportunity to talk to a guy on a boat in the South Pacific who was chasing a giant squid. No one's ever had seen a live giant squid. It'd been bodies and whatever. He thinks he was on trail of a live one. And I called his office and talked to his associate. And I said, you know, we can't give Oliver the whole hour because we need 15 minutes to talk to this guy by satellite phone. Please apologize to him. And she said, no, you don't understand. That's Oliver's favorite subject. I said, what, a giant squid? He says, yes, he loves cephalopods and giant squids and things. Can he sit in on that interview? I said, sure, he could ask questions if he wants, as far as I'm concerned. And sure enough, he came there. We rushed through his interview because he wanted to hear this guy. He came to the studio on a Friday wearing a cephalopod T-shirt. And he had two giant squids, rubber squids, in each hand, squeezing them as we went in the studio. He was ready to go. And another, as you say, unexpected things happen when you don't expect them, of course. But they're always great, little nuggets.
That's a wonderful story. Let's talk about something less wonderful. The current administration and the attitude towards science, which you so passionately and eloquently do battle against every Friday. What's your take on what's going on with attitudes towards science in America today?
Well, you know, the good news is that people love science. I know it's hard to believe, but we know from our statistics of how many millions of listeners we have from the mail, from movies and television. People love science. The Big Bang Theory is the number one rated show about geeks, physics geeks on television. A few years ago, we had two movies battling over the Oscars were about two scientists. When did that ever happen? You know, if you everywhere you go, anything that's new that comes out, whether it's even advertising, I saw an ad for a tire company the other day that began showing a female scientist driving a car, thinking about equations, and they were selling this, they were pitching the tires using a woman scientist. I say, so that good news is the people love science, and that all we can do is continue to do what we do. I mean, I don't think we're going to convince anybody, and this is something I learned a long time ago, you're never going to change really anybody's mind about something. It really takes a giant shift in attitude or something that you can't deny. And one of those things that's occurring now, I think, is global warming. Mm-hmm. You can't deny what you see and what the Earth is telling you. When there's no ice in the North Pole in the summertime, you can't deny that. And especially when the big money is in on this, when the insurance companies know the dangers of global warming and rising oceans and won't insure things that are in jeopardy, you know the decision has been made already. So all we can do is just keep presenting science to people because they love it, they'll consume it, and eventually the truth will out, no matter, you know, what people think. And they present enough evidence, and I don't say facts. Everybody has their own facts, but not everybody has their own evidence to base those facts on.
What's one thing that you've really learned that has helped you communicate best about climate science?
It is to show how climate science really affects people's lives. If I tell you, or if I tell climate science skeptics, oh, you know, the polar bears are going away, then who cares? You know, then that's not something that's going to convince them. But if I tell you in Florida, and you know this already from living in Florida, that your insurance is going to go up because the sea levels are rising, that your streets are going to be flooded because of that, or that it's going to cost you more, this and that, you're hitting people where they live. And they know that. And they can see that around them. And so don't try to convince skeptics by, you know, being preachy. Just talk to them about where it hits home.
Yeah. If I could wave my magic wand, and I do have one, it's just misplaced. I keep looking for it.
It's like my blank check I give people. It sort of gets misplaced.
Magic wand, it's somewhere on a shelf. But if I could wave it and make you the science advisor to America, what would be, like, give me a couple things you'd really like to go after?
I think President Obama had some good beginnings to some of the things I would do. First, what he did is he made scientists as public as athletes. As you know, he brought science fairs into the White House for the first time. He brought scientists. He used the office of the presidency to glorify people who were scientists as much as we glorify athletes and winners of championships and things like that. I think also that we would make education free. You know, the whole idea of science education, we should open it up to anybody who wants to be a scientist or is thinking about it, and make it easier for people to get educated. I think the media is already, as I said before, I think the media, the entertainment industry, has already recognized the viewer, the audience, loving science, and they are capitalizing on that. And I think we should allow kids to, you know, to experiment as much as they can to discover the tools of technology. We should make science, and this is what we try to do on Science Friday, as much as a topic of discussion around the dinner table as we do sports or business. We're talking about Bitcoin every day or what it's worth. Okay, that's sort of a step forward in talking about science, because you have to learn the technology of Bitcoin if you really want to understand it. Let's talk about around the table. What is the basis of Bitcoin? Well, blockchain, things like that. I don't have any magic formulas, but I know science has gone through some challenges in the past. I know it is. I'm not trying to be rah-rah about it, but we just have to stay the course and keep doing what we're doing, and also highlight new voices in science. Let's find new. That's one thing we do on Science Friday. We try to find new voices of rising young scientists, male, female, who have something to say and show that science is not done by a bunch of stodgy old people all the time, like you see in the movies, but that science really does have an element of young, exciting people to it.
Anybody standout pop into your mind that fits those qualities for you right now?
Jenna Levin, who we had a really interesting, mm-hmm. we really had an interesting Science Friday talk last week about science and the arts. And we had Jenna Levin, who was the author of Black Hole Blues, on. She's a physicist and a great speaker. And then we also had another physicist, Clifford Johnson, who wrote a comic book, or what they call a graphic novel these days, called The Dialogues. And it was really, really informative, interesting, mind-blowing, and puzzling all at the same time, which I think is a fancy way of saying you just sat down and thought about it for a while. And what was interesting in the comic book or in the graphic novel is that in 250 pages, there was not one phone conversation. There was not one person was looking at their phone at any time in those conversations. So finding young voices.
How about some older voices? Any favorites over the years, the people you just really admired?
Oh, we did have, over the years, we had Carl Sagan. We had Oliver Sacks. We had all kinds of those people. Boy, we could use, if Carl Sagan were around today, he would not be a shrinking violet. And one thing, and speaking of science and politics, as sort of a child of the 60s, what we don't see very much are a lot of citizen scientists getting more involved in politics. Back in the late 60s, we had Barry Commoner, who ran. He was from the, from St. Louis. He ran for president. We had Carl Sagan. You had Paul Ehrlich. Even before that, you had the book Silent Spring. You had all these people getting involved. There was the March for Science in Washington, where last year, where that got started, I think. There are now a few scientists, a few more scientists. There's a move called the 314, based on Pi 3.14, 314 mm-hmm. movement, trying to get more scientists to run for office. There are very few scientists in Congress. I think there's only 1-2 PhDs in Congress. So I think that that's part of the challenge of making decisions in Congress based on real ideas and on real evidence, critical thinking. And who knows? We'll see what happens.
What's your favorite thing about being Ira Flatow and doing Science Friday?
Oh, my favorite thing. Two favorite things. One is I have a great staff who basically, makes me look smart. And two, it is that always every day is a learning experience. Every moment. I mean, I don't really have a day off because I'm just soaking in stuff. I'm reading all the time. And so I'm learning something new all the time. And I'm being a yenta myself. That's what I do. As I learn something, I try to share with people what I know. Hey, guess what I learned about, black holes or the microbiome or something today. This is great. Right before we began talking, I was doing my homework about that. And that to me is a lot of fun. And when I get tired of learning, I'll know it's time to call it quits and, go retire someplace. Right? But I don't have that desire being gone yet. And there's what's that old saying about if you love what you do, you'll never work a day of your life. That's what I do. Of course, there are the hard parts of this is raising money. It's public radio. Yeah. We have to raise as much money as anybody else does to stay alive. But it is still a pleasure to do this.
Could you briefly tell us about the process of putting together a Science Friday show? What are some of the things behind the scenes that listeners may not know about how long it takes to put together an episode and some of the things that people might not think of that go into that?
We do a formal start of digging stories on a Monday. We have a Monday afternoon pitch meeting, as we call it, where we have about six producers. We're in states. Not all of them are in one place. We do a lot of telecommuting from California, from New York, other places around Pittsburgh, where some of our producers are. We all meet on sort of like Skype every Monday in New York. And we get to see the journals. This is kind of an interesting little secret. The science journals are basically published on a Thursday, but journalists are allowed to see what's going to be in the journals on a Monday, but they're not allowed to talk about it really till the publication day.
It's embargoed.
Embargoed, right. So we get to see hundreds and hundreds of these things, of little abstracts of, snippets of what's going to be coming out. That's what I was doing today. And so we have hundreds of possibilities. People pick out their own stories they like. We pick out stuff that's in the news. We pick out new books that are coming out. So that all goes into the mix. And then we have our meeting and we decide what we think. We put a roadmap together of what the 2 hours will look like on Friday. And if something changes, we'll change it during the week. The biggest decision we make, at least my decision I make, is what to leave out, because we have so much to put in. And the question is, we can look at these stories and we can see, oh, this is going to be a big popular story. And I'll say, well, should we cover it? If everybody else is going to cover it, why don't we take this little story that's just as interesting and thought-provoking, and give that, some radio time, some podcast time. So it's sort of it's a little dance we do between, can we do the big story better and do stuff that no one else will talk about because we have more time to talk about it? Or should we give a little story, which no one will do, but we'll get people to think about it. And so we do a little bit of both. And then the week goes on and things change and somebody may make a comment that we need to cover, or we'll slide things in and out. But more or less, we'll stay intact until Thursday. And we'll try to find out how good we are, with sealing everything in place Thursday afternoon. And then Friday morning, we'll get together. All the heavy duty writing for the hour starts, the introductions and all the stuff that you hear. And we'll get that done by around noon. And at 1 o'clock, we'll go into Eastern time. We'll go into our studios and start pre-recording certain introductory things. And then show goes live an hour after that. And I love live radio. I say to my staff, I say, anybody who wants to try this? And they all go cringing. And I say, no, this is the joy. I'm sure you feel the same way. This is the joy of doing this stuff, isn't it?
I love doing live radio. It's just so fun and exciting. And it's more natural. You're just having a conversation and this is happening and away we go.
Yeah. And we also, one of the elements of our live radio, and it's probably true of you too, is the element of having the audience ask questions. I mean, we're one of the few times, a few places, where the audience, we can bring a scientist on and the audience can actually talk to a living, breathing science person that they, they've probably never talked to before. And the questions they ask are a lot of times better than anything I have come up with. So it's fun to have the audience element also there.
I would be remiss amongst a lot of my friends and fans if I didn't ask you about a certain television show that you were on. Tell me about how that happened. How did you get to interview Sheldon on The Big Bang Theory?
I was on my third time this year. I was on in October, I think, the second episode this season. And it started about, started about 6 years ago. I got a call from the producers of The Big Bang Theory out of the blue. I didn't know who they, they knew me. And they said, would you come on the show? We want you to interview Sheldon Cooper. And I said, oh, it's a great show. I love it. You want me to come out to California? No, you just stay where you are. We're going to pre-record. We're going to play the first episode I was in. They played a trick on Sheldon Cooper where they pumped helium into his office. So, it makes his voice squeaky. They said, we want to do that, but we want him to be interviewed by you on Science Friday. We were trying to think of what radio show could we put Sheldon on, and everybody raised the writers all raised their hand and said, Science Friday, what else, So I did that the first time, and that was great. And then about 4 years later, I got another call. They said, hey, we want you to come back on again. And I said, okay, you want to do that kind of thing? They said, no. This time we're going to build a studio. We're going to build a replica of your studio here in Hollywood. You come out to Hollywood, to Warner Brothers. We're going to build a replica on the stage, and you can come out and interview in your studio. Sheldon and Leonard in the studio, and they sent me the script. It was just great. And I was such a fanboy when I got out there. And I was just walking around the studio. I got to sit in Sheldon's seat, you know, his seat.
On the couch?
On the couch.
Oh,
I was sitting on the couch.
Hallowed ground.
It was great. I mean, I sent them 360 pictures of the studio. They had totally reproduced it. And people were coming over me. It was great. I had a great time. And on third time, which was this October, I went back to do another episode, and I was totally ignored. I was, you know, it was the good news and the bad news was that, you know, no one was coming up to me like, oh, wow, we're so great to have you, except a few, few of the people. But the good news was, well, now I was just an actor. I was just one of the actors of Hollywood who, hey, happened to be here, you know. I was sort of just accepted as a Hollywood person. I was on a TV show, so what, you know.
Yeah, you're just part of the cast and crew.
Yes, part of the cast and crew. It was still great. I still enjoyed it. And, you know, the most amazing part about my appearance this time was the issue that the TV episode tackled. I mean, it was really very brave of the producers and the writers to tackle the issue about, and the main topic of this was physics in trouble. It's actually the same issue we talked about last week. Is there a problem in physics that has stumped the scientists? And they admitted there was a problem in physics in the show. On the Big Bang Theory, and what are we going to do about it? And they spent a good 20 minutes talking about it, and then at the end, and of course they used language that no one really understood, supersymmetry, physical concepts that went over a lot of people's head, but they were brave enough to do that. And in the end, they wound up in the cemetery at Richard Feynman's grave, which is out there, and they had a drink together to Richard Feynman, because Richard Feynman said, you don't have to have a reason to study physics, you just have to enjoy doing it. And that's what they did. And the writers and the producers knew how important this was, even bringing Richard Feynman, who was a very famous physicist, and one of my great role models as a scientist. And they put this all together, and it was great. It was great to be part of that idea where they challenged what we knew about physics and then found the reason why it didn't matter what we think we know. It's just the fun and the joy, as Richard Feynman used to say, of doing science.
What do you do when you're not sciencing, Mr. Flato? Because my students, they all think that I just do science all the time.
Yeah. Well, two of my great passions. One of my great passions is gardening, and is specifically orchids. I grow orchids, a lot of orchids. I have about 36 on my windowsill as it's 10 degrees outside here in the east. But I have been doing that for about 25, 30 years. And the other thing I just got into, started doing now, is learning how to bake bread. Mm-hmm. But I'm doing it, the way Michael Pollan does it, trying to imitate how Michael Pollan does it the natural way. Now, no yeast. I just let the dough sit out there and collect the yeast from the air. And, so it's fermentation. I actually started fermenting my own homegrown pickles, and it got me interested in fermentation. And because one of our favorite topics on Science Friday is the microbiome. And there's a microbiome in the soil, as you know, and microbiome in our bodies. And now there's microbiome in yeast, in bread. It's amazing. One Michael Pollan's book, called Cooked. It's an older book. It talks about all this stuff. So that's one of my latest things. Besides, the geeky part of me is trying to modernize my electronic devices in my home, you know, so they'll talk to each other.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's definitely the thing now.
That's the thing. And, you know, the older I get, the more I get to be 17 again. The geekier, nerdy I get about this kind of stuff. I find myself doing more and more of these things I used to do in my basement.
Alrighty, sir. Ira Flato from PRI's Science Friday.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you, David. Good luck.
We're going to take a short break, thanks to our very special guest, Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. When we come back, we'll be talking to a United States Geological Survey researcher who was on the ground immediately after the devastating debris flows that swept through Montecito in Southern California. This is Blue Dot, and I'm your host, Dave Shlohm. Stay with us. And we're back. Thanks for joining us here on North State Public Radio. Our next guest is Francis Renger. Francis is a geomorphologist with the United States Geological Survey. He was part of a USGS team of scientists that went to Montecito in Southern California after the tragic debris flow that took 20 lives. The Thomas Fire, one of the largest in California history, denuded the mountains above the coastal community. Heavy rains in January then caused a massive mud and boulder flow that destroyed homes with a tragic loss of life. Francis joins us via Skype. Francis Rangers, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start out with explain to us what exactly is a debris flow.
Yeah, so a debris flow is a mix of large boulders and cobbles that accumulate and they can even contain trees in the mix. And the slurry sorts itself such that the largest material tends to move at the front, like a large wall of rubble. And it's often followed by a long watery tail that's more like a flood. So debris flows are defined particularly by the material that they carry. And these are distinct from mud flows, which are typically just fine material, the mud that people are familiar with. But debris flows carry large boulders the size of cars. So that's why we make that distinction.
And let's talk about this particular event. This happened as a consequence of the Thomas Fire, right?
Yeah, it was certainly exacerbated by the Thomas Fire. What happened was a large amount of rainfall fell on a burned area. And in burned areas, typically water doesn't soak into the soil like it does in unburned areas. So rather than acting like a sponge, the ground is more like a parking lot. Then the water flows into small rills and gullies and streams and moves through mountain canyons where it can pick up debris. So in unburned areas, typically the rain would just soak into the soil.
When did you first become involved in this? When did you get the call as a member of the USGS team to go in and study the aftermath of this?
We heard about it, I guess it was the next morning when we got into the office, and then we were on the ground that evening along with first responders. So we couldn't actually get in to look at the area while it was initially being search for people that still needed rescued. But we were on the ground. Two of my colleagues were there, and they were did an overflight the day after. And then within a few days, we were allowed to walk in and start to map the debris flow area.
And what were your initial impressions? What did you see first?
It was startling. Some of the things I saw were houses that were buried up to the eaves. But what was a little more disturbing were sometimes we would just see foundations and a house would be completely gone. It wasn't just knocked off the foundation, but it was moved out of sight. So the power of these debris flows was really impressive, and it wasn't like anything I'd ever seen up to this point.
And what was it? I don't know how quite to ask this, but it has to be difficult to be trying to study an area like this as a scientist when it's an area where, when it's a place where such a tragedy occurred and lives were lost. What was that like?
That was really unique. I've never experienced that aspect of it before. Typically in the debris flow areas we work in, there often aren't fatalities involved. It was a different experience seeing people walking around searching for folks who had been affected, and it just added a maybe more motivation for us to continue doing the research we're doing, so we can continue to inform people about these kind of hazards and to understand them a little bit better.
What are some lessons so far that you guys have learned from this?
What we've been doing so far is mapping the extent of material and that was moved. And one of the lessons I think that we take away is the influence of infrastructure on routing these flows. So an example of that is a lot of mud moved across a bridge that crossed Highway 101. And typically, if I was going to try and model a debris flow, I wouldn't account for necessarily roads or things like bridges. I would just use the natural topography. But here, I saw that roads were really important in routing material of these debris flows. And so that's something that we're going to have to consider as we move forward with modeling, because if we don't think that things can move across bridges, then we'll be really wrong in our predictions.
And what is the potential for future hazard in that area? Did most of the debris come flowing down from the mountaintop, or is there still a lot left that, you know, potentially could cause another event like this?
There's still a potential for an event to occur again if they have another large rainstorm. There's a concern if it rains really hard again this winter that something again could happen. There's still plenty of debris upstream that could move down. However, the longer time there is between now and when the vegetation grows back, the better. So I think the next few months are very critical. And as we move out of the rainy season and towards the summer, things are going to continue to improve. But these areas tend to be susceptible to debris flows between 1 to 3 years after a wildfire. So people in the area should definitely be vigilant and be aware of any large rainstorms that might be headed their way.
Do you think that there were decisions perhaps made that could have been better, that could have saved lives in this case?
You know, I don't have enough information to really make a evaluation or a judgment call on that. I guess I would just recommend to anybody that's out there and that might hear warnings about potential for debris flows to definitely take it seriously. I'm not saying that anybody didn't do that in this case, but just it's important to definitely realize that a debris flow is something you can't outrun. Once it's barreling down on you, there's not much you can do.
Now, do you study other types of debris flows, like, for example, volcanic mud flows and lahars, things like that?
I don't personally. I actually focus primarily on post-wildfire debris flows. So this is my main area of expertise. However, there are quite a few similarities between volcanic-derived debris flows and the ones we saw here. However, in some ways, these may be more powerful because some of the large boulders that are in place upstream of Montecito, for example, are much larger than you might see in volcanic areas that are dominated by ash.
When did you first get interested in studying geology in general, and then specifically geomorphology? And explain to us what exactly is geomorphology.
I guess my first interest really came about in college. I really enjoyed hiking, the outdoors, and science. And so geology is sort of a natural fit for that. And geomorphology is a sub-discipline that people tend to call, my favorite definition of it is the science of scenery. So geomorphology explains what you see on the surface of the earth. So it explains mountains and coastlines and all the things that kind of make a nice landscape postcard. It's that we investigate the processes that shape geomorphology, that shape the earth's surface in geomorphology. And my primary interest in the subject of post-wildfire debris flows really came from some work that the writer John McPhee did in the 80s. He wrote a really nice article in the New Yorker that ended up being turned into a book called The Control of Nature, where he writes about fires and their ability to create conditions that make debris flows very likely in the Southern California area. So this phenomenon is it's not new. It's definitely a concern that's been there, and it's been known for many years. And it's something that everyone in Southern California is going to have to continue to live with, just because of the mixture of vegetation and fire and steep tectonic mountains.
Well, Francis, I appreciate you spending the time with us. Will you be heading back there to study that site anytime soon?
Yeah, we're continuing to work on processing the data we've gathered so far, but we'll be in and out of the area for quite a while because we really want to understand all the science behind what happened there.
Well, appreciate you spending your time with us today and letting us know about this. This was a tragic story, but also something important and fascinating.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks again to our guests, Ira Flato from Public Radio International Science Friday and research geologist Francis Rengers from the United States Geological Survey. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Schloem. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and co-produced by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.